Ladies and gentlemen, the U.S. District Judge Roger Benitez of San Diego has once again struck down California's assault weapon ban. So it is once again time for us to do a quick recap of stuff going on in the legal sphere. Welcome back to another T-Rex Talk. Now, you probably are on the political newsletter that T-Rex Arm sends out somewhat sporadically, as there is news. And we already sent you a link to this particular ruling from Judge Benitez. But a number of you wrote back and actually asked for a podcast episode that was presumably easier to listen to in the car than that newsletter, and goes into a little more depth discussing some of the things brought up in the ruling. So I want to do that. Someone else also pointed out that I should have mentioned that some of the lawsuits that have been brought by various plaintiffs in California against the state of California should be mentioned, specifically Reno May. And it completely slipped my mind to include him because I have been following him on the internet just as a content creator, as a GunTuber. But it should be noted that Reno May Guns is not just a YouTube channel. It's a guy who has gone to bat for rights, gun rights, in this country, and specifically in the state of California. So I do want to give credit where it is due. Being a plaintiff in one of these cases is not simple. It is not easy. So kudos to Reno May and others who have been standing up to their own governments and calling them to account. And kudos to those judges who are applying the law properly and applying the precedent handed down by the Supreme Court in that Bruin decision. So let's get to our main story. Benitez is a guy who has handed down a number of pro-gun freedom rulings, but almost all of his rulings have been squashed by the Ninth Circuit. He has struck down the assault weapons ban before. He also has struck down magazine bans. He is the reason that we actually had Freedom Week. There was an entire week in which the magazine ban in California had been overturned. It was later replaced under appeal, but there was an entire week where magazines legally flooded into California. And that is just a really interesting thing. Now, in this particular case, he struck down California's assault weapon ban, but the Attorney General of California, Rob Bonta, has already appealed the case. It's going to go to the Ninth Circuit. So his ruling doesn't actually go into effect until after the Ninth Circuit decides whether or not to let it go through. So if you live in California, you cannot just go out and buy anything that you want at the moment. You kind of have to wait and see what happens. But in the meantime, he wrote a fantastic ruling that you can read. And I think that it is notable because it includes an awful lot of really good arguments. The state of California brought some of their best arguments and brought some of their best experts. And remember that the Bruin decision has been something that has been on the books for over a year now. So there are a lot of attempts to find holes in the historical test and look for examples like Bowie knives and things that might be able to get through that historical test and make it okay, constitutionally okay, to disarm Americans. So this particular ruling that he has written really covers a lot of the old myths about gun control, gun violence, etc., but also a lot of the new tactics that are being used. And he addresses those really well. So it is just a fantastic document to read. But if you're in the car and you would prefer to listen to a podcast, which you are currently doing, we will go through that and we will pull some really good quotes and discuss those. Now, on a strategic note, it is actually a really interesting thing that this case is going to go before the Ninth Circuit. Now, the Ninth Circuit Court is almost certainly going to slap Benitez's ruling down again. But there is an opportunity for this case to be appealed again and then go all the way to the Supreme Court. And that would be a really ideal thing from a freedom standpoint. And in some ways, the gun control advocates don't actually want this particular case to go to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court would probably rule on Benitez's side that the state of California does not have a leg to stand on when it comes to disarming its own people. Ideally, for the gun control advocates, this is a court case that should not have come up in California, and the Ninth Court should really drag this out as long as possible in the hopes that we will get a different set of Supreme Court justices who will rule more that they would prefer to rule. Not originalists, not constitutionalists, but people who would just sort of be statists. In fact, there was an article from Shannon Watts just a couple weeks ago. This was an article that she wrote for CNN, an op-ed, demanding that we rapidly pack the Supreme Court with a whole bunch of new judges just to, you know, outweigh the ones that we currently have. And I'm not going to link to that article, but I am going to link to an article by Hand-Waving Freakoutery, which is a cool blog. And he goes through her article and kind of dispenses with some of her statistical data. Hand-Waving Freakoutery is a blog written by a really good statistician, somebody who is really good at crunching the numbers. And it's a fantastic resource for people that would like to get down to the raw data and understand some of the nitty-gritty of different gun control arguments that are made. He has a fascinating study that he published years ago pointing out that firearm violence does not in any way correlate with firearm ownership. What does correlate is fatherlessness. So, have a look around on his Substack, because there's quite a bit of interesting stuff in there. But anyway, he goes over the Shannon Watts article pointing out the folly of this idea that if the Supreme Court will not rule the way that you want it to rule, you just stack the deck while you have the political capability to do so with as many partisan judges as you can, and then you try to prevent the other side from stacking the deck when they have more political power. So, yeah, it's a decent read. FDR tried to stack the Supreme Court because a lot of his efforts to build a giant and more powerful state were restrained by the Supreme Court of his time. So he wanted to build a brand new Supreme Court with a bunch of brand new appointees that he would stick in there. Unfortunately, that did not happen, because the New Deal was bad enough as it is, even with that restraint. But on a positive note, I want to point out that even though Benitez's ruling is waiting on the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit is unlikely to allow this thing through, there are a bunch of cases that are being won at the Supreme Court level, and a bunch of cases that are being won even outside of the Supreme Court. In the last few weeks, we've had rulings on a couple of cases. Brito versus ATF is an excellent one. The judge there, as a district court judge, said that the ATF is not allowed to just make up new rules, banning things like pistol braces. And most of the defeats that the ATF has suffered recently in court are interesting, because they have nothing to do with the Second Amendment at all. They're entirely about the jurisdictional limits of the ATF itself. Is it allowed to make entirely new rules that essentially constitute legislation, which, you know, they're not a legislative body, they're an enforcement body. So making these kind of new sweeping rules that utterly change the scope of the laws that they have been given by Congress and utterly ignore the rules of the Constitution, that is where they're losing the most ground. And this is actually a very good thing to bring up. It is nice to see courts that still believe that government must have some limitations. But let's get back to Benitez. He is ruling specifically on the assault weapons ban in California, and he begins by saying, like the Bowie knife, which was commonly carried by citizens and soldiers in the 1800s, assault weapons, in quotation marks, are dangerous but useful. But unlike the Bowie knife, the United States Supreme Court has said there is a long tradition of widespread lawful ownership, gun ownership, by private individuals in this country. So this is a very important point that he is making, but it's also kind of a fun zinger. The first time that he struck down the California assault weapons ban, he started off his proclamation, his ruling, by saying that AR-15s are like Swiss Army knives in that they are useful for both soldiers and citizens, and that they have many modifications, and they have many capabilities. And commentators just kind of lost their minds. They were like, what kind of idiot equates a gun and a knife, confuses a gun and a knife? That was most of the news coverage of his last ruling. So it's kind of fun that he's doubled down on the guns and knives comparisons by starting off his second ruling on the same thing the same way. But there's actually kind of a twist this time, which I'll get to in a minute. He continues by describing the right of the individual to keep and bear firearms, really, really simple and obvious stuff. And then he lays out the case that California, the state of California, is making, that California needs to restrict people's rights in order to protect people. And he describes kind of how the assault weapons ban in California actually works by limiting features or accessories. And apart from those features or accessories, obviously, the AR-15s in California are still at heart AR-15s. And so he's asking the question, like, what is it that actually makes these things assault weapons? And then he goes into some statistics. The state of California says criminals already have and favor using guns described as assault weapons. And rather than being outgunned, many citizens want these same firearms as a defense against criminal attacks. Americans today own 24.4 million modern rifles, i.e. AR-15 and AK-47 platform rifles, according to the state's expert. And then there's a bunch of footnotes here, which I won't read. If you're interested, there will be a link in the description. You can read the original article, and it has all the footnotes in it. And it is a great educational resource. Of the AR-15 rifle owners surveyed, 61% said one reason they acquired the gun is for home defense. This is a nationwide survey, not a California survey. But in California, he says, consequently, while criminals already have these modern semi-automatics, the state of California prohibits its citizens from buying and possessing the same guns for self-defense. At the same time, these firearms are commonly possessed by law-abiding gun owners elsewhere across the country. And then he cites a bunch of statistics that you probably already know because we've talked about them many, many times in the firearm industry. A large survey estimates that guns are needed defensively approximately 1.6 million times per year. He talks about the CDC report that there are somewhere between 500,000 and 3 million defensive gun uses in the United States every year. So again, a lot of footnoted studies, just a handy resource. And then he lists a whole bunch of times when people did in fact use assault rifles, again in quotes, specifically AR-15s, to defend themselves and defend others. He then goes over a bunch of statistics, how often rifles are used to commit crimes. 447 people were killed with rifles of all types in the entire country. If all of those homicides were committed with AR-15s, that would mean that less than 0.00018% of AR-15s were used for homicide. So this begs the question, says Benitez, what were the other AR-15 type rifles used for? The only logical answer is that 24,000,000.39999 of AR-15s were used for lawful purposes. Then he goes into some specific California statistics and just describes some more of the positions of the state of California, trying to balance the rights of the people versus the danger of the weapons and why they need to be taken away. This argument that a handgun ban might be justified because government-approved alternatives are available was rejected in Heller, and it is rejected here. Heller said quite clearly that it is no constitutional answer for government to say that it is permissible to ban some guns as long as other guns are allowed. This is not the way American constitutional rights work. It is not permissible for a state to ban some books simply because there are other books to read, or to close synagogues because churches and mosques are open. In their normal configurations, the so-called assault weapons banned in California are modern firearms commonly owned by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes across the nation. And under Heller, McDonald, Satano, and Bruin, they may not be banned. I think it is important, the point that he is making, that the government isn't allowed to take away lots and lots and lots of your freedoms, and then say you are still free because you have a little bit of freedom left. That is not the way that constitutional rights work. That is not the way that government limitations work. It is very important, I think, that we think about our rights, not just as things that we have, but as proof that the government does, in fact, have limited jurisdiction. If the government is allowed to take away all your rights except one, then the government doesn't really have the limitations. This limited jurisdiction is the key point that I think that we need to come back to and really start our thinking from, as opposed to what is it that we actually have. The question is not, do you have the right to a gun or a type of gun? The question is the government allowed to tell you what you're allowed to have? Is the government allowed to take away things that it doesn't want you to have? That is a more fundamental question that the Founding Fathers wanted to address. So now we get to the part of the document where he explains Bruin's historical test. Bruin says, when the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual's conduct, the Constitution presumptively protects that conduct. The government must then justify its regulation by demonstrating that it is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. Only then may a court conclude that the individual's conduct falls outside the Second Amendment's unqualified command. Now, that phrase, unqualified command, is extremely important. That comes directly from the Bruin case that is supposed to be the new precedent. And it is very important that we talk about this unqualified command part. So a lot of people, when they discuss the Second Amendment, they say that shall not be infringed does, in fact, have a qualification. And that qualification is you have to be part of a regulated militia. A well-regulated militia is the qualification for you having your guns. But that is not how the Second Amendment was written. The Second Amendment says that because a well-regulated militia is a very important thing for a country to have, a necessary thing for a country to have, the right of the people to keep and bear arms must not be infringed, and that is an unqualified command. Obviously, a militia cannot arise from an unarmed people, and so there is no qualification that limits the right of the people to be armed. The militia is a justification, not a qualification. And this historical test is important. You have to find a historical tradition of firearm regulation in the United States around the time of the founding to prove that there is some sort of way to prevent the keeping and bearing of arms. Now, one of the things that the state of California has asked for is more time to study the historical record and find some laws in the past, in the late 1700s, early 1800s, when firearms were prohibited from ownership. They need to find some of this stuff, and they've asked for more time to look for it. And Judge Benitez has said no. The state has been given generous time and leeway to satisfy its new burden. Additional time to study history is not needed. The state's experts have been studying historical firearms regulations for more than 20 years. This court has reviewed all the declarations of the state's experts and historians, as well as their cited sources, and finds no support for the state's ban. He goes on to say, in the United States, with its long tradition of gun ownership, there are no historical laws prohibiting simple possession of any type of firearm until long after the 1868 adoption of the 14th Amendment. That is too late. Post-ratification adoption or acceptance of laws that are inconsistent with the original meaning of the constitutional text cannot overcome or alter that text. Nevertheless, having significant time to do so, the state has identified no national tradition of firearm regulation so broad in its coverage or so far-reaching in its effect as its extreme assault weapons statutes. Now, let's go over a little bit of some of the things that the state did bring. They found some historical laws. They found some traditions that they brought out to try to justify their assault weapons ban. And we should be aware of these things. If you've listened to some past episodes where we were talking about Oregon's assault weapons ban and magazine ban, you already know what some of these things are. One of the things that will be brought up is, well, there weren't any advanced high-capacity magazines back then. There weren't any repeating rifles back then. There was no way for the founders to have anticipated multi-shot devices at that time. And if they had known, if they'd only thought a little bit about the mechanical future of firearms, they certainly would have allowed for the regulation of those firearms. And Judge Benitez has a whole list of things. He talks about when Winchester repeating rifles came about, how widely used they were by civilians, how there was absolutely no restriction whatsoever of their ownership, nor of Gatling guns, nor of repeating rifles ahead of time, nor of repeating air rifles that were around not only at the time of the founders, but famously used by Lewis and Clark. Like, a lot of the things that you've already heard about are in this particular document and being cited by a judge with footnotes, so you can go and find some of the original research. And another one that's pretty common is there were colonial restrictions on how much gunpowder you could have at your house. But this had nothing to do with firearms or weaponry. This was just towns and cities had fire codes so that you couldn't keep many barrels of gunpowder in your house because of the fire hazard that it was. And these towns and sometimes cities often had public magazines, a really safe, sturdy building where you could store your large barrels of gunpowder safely, and then have a small amount at your house for all of your necessary firearm type activities. Again, this is fire code stuff. This is not Second Amendment stuff. Now, some of the state's experts made the case that since there's not a whole lot of stories of people using repeating rifles and Gatling guns for self-defense, it is safe to assume that those things were in fact restricted. But Judge Benitez says, no, that's not how this works. If these laws were on the books, we would have records of these laws being on the books. These laws were not on the books. There were no restrictions. And here are some historical examples of miners and cowboys and homesteaders actually using large capacity repeating Winchester rifles in specific states to defend themselves, even though this is not a lot of cases. Even though this is not hundreds of thousands of times that this happened, this is proof that these weapons were out there, they were being used in self-defense, and we can see that there is no legal prohibition against their ownership or use. The state also brought up something that I had completely forgot about, which was gun traps. I haven't read about gun traps in years and years and years, but there were, in fact, laws preventing the use of guns set as traps. A good example of this is in the colony of New Jersey in 1771. But the state is saying that gun traps being forbidden is the same as firearms being regulated. But a gun trap is a really interesting thing. What it is basically, most of them were little cast iron stands that you would set a gun on, and then there would be a tripwire that pulls the trigger of the weapon. And the really clever ones actually set the weapon on a pivot, so that as a creature, a rabbit or a deer, pulls that tripwire, it actually pivots the gun towards whichever tripwire is being triggered and fires the gun in that direction. Now, obviously, this is a very dangerous thing to have lying around in New Jersey, even back in 1771. This is a very deadly trap that could kill a person by accident. And so it makes a lot of sense for the use of a gun trap to be prohibited. The state is saying this counts as firearm regulation. Judge Benitez points out, no, this is merely a type of use of a firearm. A dangerous and careless way of using a firearm is prohibited, but the firearm is not. The firearm ownership is not. In fact, that particular law from New Jersey says, nothing herein contained shall be construed to extend to prevent any person carrying a gun upon the king's highway in this colony. So even back then, the lawmakers were like, we better make this really, really clear. This has nothing to do with weapon regulation. This is only dangerous trap regulation. This is way too easy to commit manslaughter with this thing. Get your deer a different way. And then, of course, the state also brings up some knife laws, because late in the 1800s, too late, I would say, but late in the 1800s, there were, in fact, restrictions on how you could carry certain types of knives, specifically bowie knives. The bowie knife laws are really interesting because technically there is nothing that is, legally speaking, or even technically defined as a bowie knife. Bowie knife is an entirely marketing-driven term. There's a couple of characteristics that a bowie knife is supposed to have, but it is not legally defined by size, length, weight, number of sharpened edges, etc. There were just laws prohibiting bowie knives, but not ownership of bowie knives, specifically in certain states. The concealed carry of Bowie knives. You could still own them. You could still carry them. You could just not conceal them about your person. And these are the kind of capricious and arbitrary laws that you get after, let's say, a really lurid, highly publicized disaster, like some kind of mass shooting or something. And in this case, what really drove a lot of these Bowie knives was a fascinating scenario that played out in the Arkansas legislature, where one of the elected officials attacked the Speaker of the House with a Bowie knife and did him considerable damage. But the Speaker of the House had his own concealed Bowie knife and was able to defend himself with lethal force, against lethal force, kill his attacker and survive. And as you can imagine, that made some headlines. That was a pretty big deal. That caused a lot of states to ban the concealed carry of Bowie knives. Now, even back then, I think that the state and the newspaper reporters got things a little bit wrong, because on the one hand, yes, that particular instance is an example of how deadly, dangerous a concealed Bowie knife deployed by an elected official can be. But it also is a perfect example of what a great defensive weapon a concealed Bowie knife can be when it is used to defend your life against someone who is attacking you. Nevertheless, there were a number of Bowie knife laws passed, probably because that was just such a politically dynamite event that was front page news absolutely everywhere. And I don't actually know how widely those knife laws were enforced. But in some ways, it doesn't matter, because knife laws are not the same as gun laws. As Benitez points out, because the state cannot find a historic regulation of firearms, it turns to the historic regulations of weapons, whether bladed weapons, melee weapons, blunt weapons, or lead-filled weapons. Yet the Supreme Court does not look to knife laws when reviewing a restriction about guns. Bruin teaches that a state's burden is to identify a historical tradition of firearm regulation, not a tradition of knife regulation. So that funny twist that I mentioned at the beginning is that now, when people on the internet invariably will mock Judge Benitez for not knowing that guns and knives are different, they don't understand he's not the one actually making that point. It is, in fact, the state of California trying to say that they are, in fact, the same. And some of the experts point out, like, well, just there's a general vibe in the past of you know, the police having control over people's ability to do stuff. So that's good enough. And Benitez says, no, here is a quote. Between 1607 and 1815, the colonial and state governments of what would become the first 14 states neglected to exercise any police power over the ownership of guns by members of the body politic. These limits on colonial and early state regulations of arms ownership outlined a significant zone of immunity around the private arms of the individual citizen. So basically, you have no gun laws in the northern states for 50-plus years. And then in the southern states for 50-plus years, the same. No real gun laws. And then out in the territories, sometimes it gets a little weird. Like, the state goes for this long shot, says Benitez, where they find a law in 1885 way out in the Montana Territory. And the name of this particular law is Threateningly Drawing Deadly Weapons Prohibited. So this is a law that prohibits threateningly drawing a deadly weapon. It does not prohibit carrying it. It does not prohibit owning it. It does not even prohibit drawing it. It's basically an anti-brandishing bill. And of course, if you read the actual law, it does provide an exception where you can draw the weapon to use it in self-defense. Essentially, throughout the states and the territories, you just get no firearm restrictions at all, until you look at some specific racist laws. And these laws don't really have anything to do with what the people can own. It has more to do with who actually is people. Nevertheless, the state of California does try to use some of these laws as justifications for their treatment of California citizens. Benitez says, though the state suggests that these despicable legislative efforts might somehow be relevant to determining the traditions that define the scope of the Second Amendment, that makes little sense. One reason is that these laws treated our citizens as non-citizens, that were not entitled to fully enjoy constitutional rights. In other words, the legislators who passed these embarrassments were not concerned with the Second Amendment rights of citizens, therefore, they are here disregarded. And that is where Benitez stops that particular section. I personally, not being a sitting judge, would have gone on to point out that it is telling that that is the case that is being made by California's prosecutors and lawyers, that it is okay for us to ban the citizens of California from having certain rights, unalienable rights, because they are somehow unimportant. Employees of the state are a different kind of citizen than just people who live there. And after this section, we talk about some of the witnesses, some of the historical experts and industry experts. And generally speaking, Benitez is pretty down on these people's testimony. And he goes into a lot of detail why. Professor Cornell is one of the state's expert witnesses, a man who has been studying and writing about historic gun laws for decades. And Benitez says his opinions tend to reach out beyond historical facts and overinterpret judicial decisions. One example is his sweeping opinion that at the time of the 14th Amendment, Americans were apprehensive about the proliferation of especially dangerous weapons and the societal harms they caused. And in support, he cites McDonald, but McDonald says no such thing. he goes on to point out that Professor Cornell just doesn't really know how to read these legal cases. The antebellum court decisions upon which Professor Cornell rests do not say what he contends they say. Perhaps he is to be forgiven because he is a historian rather than a member of the bar, but his opinions are not persuasive and are entitled to no weight. So here's what I think is kind of going on here. It is not just the fact that Cornell is a historian and not a lawyer. I think that the bigger issue is that he doesn't really understand what the people of that era were thinking. He is thinking about rights as something that the government, an unlimited, large 20th century state, grants to its subjects, as opposed to what the founders were thinking at the time. The state is a very limited jurisdiction. It has very specific laws and duties, and it has no power outside of those. The lens through which you read some of these old court cases is really, really important, and obviously is helped by a knowledge of actual, you know, jurisprudence. But the state brought other witnesses besides historians. Ryan Bussey is somebody that we've talked about on the podcast. I reviewed his book a while back, and he occasionally pops up in these podcast episodes because he works for the Giffords Group. He's a senior advisor to the Giffords Group, which is a virulently anti-gun company. They're very pro-gun control. And Bussey also, of course, used to be a former firearms executive. He worked for Kimber. And so he is trying to pitch himself as, it depends on who he's talking to, but occasionally he pitches himself as an unbiased, middle-of-the-road guy, someone who has seen both sides of the fence, and he is the sane voice in the room. Other times, he pitches himself as someone who has seen the dark, dark underbelly of the firearm industry. He's the only one that knows its true dangers. He is the prophet who can explain to people what needs to be done. But obviously, working for Giffords kind of makes it impossible for you to claim that you are an unbiased person in this conversation. And Judge Benitez doesn't really go into that so much, but he points out that Kimber is a manufacturer and seller that specializes in pistols and revolvers, but not AR-15 platform rifles. The few rifles sold by his former firm are traditional bolt action models. Bussey opines that a firearm does not need any of the devices, accessories, configurations listed in the assault weapon ban, but it is not at all clear what expertise he has to support his opinion. He does not describe any professional experience using AR-15 rifles for sport or self-defense. In any event, this type of opinion is not relevant to the question of whether the state may ban a firearm that is commonly owned by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes and does not fit the prerequisites for Federal Rule of Evidence 702. So, disregard it. And now we get to some of the newer arguments. Benitez points out that one of the things that is particularly under attack is this idea. AR-15 rifles, that assault weapons, so to speak, are commonly owned by law-abiding persons for lawful purposes. And the reason for that is there's this idea that a specifically unusual weapon can be banned by the government because a rifle cane was banned that way one time. There is historical precedent for that a long time ago. But a weapon that is not rare, not unusual, should not be banned. And so the case is ostensibly that AR-15s are, in fact, not in common use. A witness for the state suggests that although such rifles number more than 24 million among Americans, a smaller number of people, 7.9 million people, might own most of them. 7,900,000 persons is still a large number of citizens choosing to own AR-15-type firearms. When the Supreme Court vacated Satano's conviction for mere possession of a stun gun, 200,000 owners of stun guns was all that it took. The burden of proof is on the government, as this court pointed out in its earlier decision. The constitutional imperative is on the government to not infringe. The corrective starting orientation is that no arm may be prohibited. If a plaintiff challenges the government's prohibition, it is on the government first to prove the banned arm is dangerous and unusual, and if not, that it is not commonly possessed, or not commonly possessed by law-abiding citizens, or not commonly possessed for lawful purposes or militia readiness. If the state cannot so prove, the challenged prohibition must be struck down. But once again, the burden is on the government to prove that remarkable claim, that if Americans own 400 million guns and 400 million gun crimes are not being committed, then Americans are using their guns for something other than crime. If Americans own 24 million AR-15s and 24 million gun crimes are not being committed with AR-15s, Americans must be using them for lawful purposes. Some people actively use AR-15s for hunting or sport or target practice. Probably the vast majority of Americans that own guns keep them and use them for self-defense in the same way that a driver puts on a seatbelt in the case of a collision. Although collisions rarely happen, the seatbelt is used for protection and ready for the unexpected collision. A reserve canopy is being used on a parachute jump, although it is not deployed, in case the main parachute fails. A cell phone in one's pocket is being used when waiting for a telephone call or when one might need to make a call. An AR-15 under one's bed at night is being used for self-defense, even when the night is quiet. I think this is a really, really good point because we have allowed, all of us kind of do this. When we hear the argument that weapons are not being used for self-defense, we pull out active examples. And I think that it is helpful to have those active examples. But he just points out several active examples of people using AR-15s to defend their homes and their families, even strangers around them. But we still need to start off with this particular point here. Do we actually have to find examples to prove that these weapons are used that way? I got a lot of smoke detectors in my house that are being used 24/7, even though they only actually detect smoke when we're cooking bacon, for some reason. It does kind of come back to the lens that you look through some of these things at. The state then makes a passing argument that weapons with this configuration are prohibited by the assault weapon ban because they are military weapons, practically indistinguishable from assault rifles like the M16. Why is that a problem? Staples explains that the M16 is a fully automatic machine gun. But undercutting its own argument, the state says that machine guns may be banned, while at the same time acknowledging in its own briefing that machine guns are not banned under federal law. In fact, there are 700,000 machine guns lawfully registered in the nation. So many lawfully owned machine guns suggests that the state's approach of banning semi-automatic AR-15s is infringing. Then talks more about state powers. The state claims that the Second Amendment is not to be read literally. Instead, it claims that the history of the Second Amendment demonstrates that governments enjoyed robust police powers to regulate weapons, including who may possess them, where they may be possessed, and what weapons may be possessed and used. But, as was shown above, that is inaccurate. I also think it's funny, the government enjoyed robust police powers. Interesting turn of phrase. Governments did and do enjoy a police power to criminalize the use of a firearm to commit other crimes, such as assault or murder. However, governments did not possess the power to regulate who among law-abiding citizens could possess firearms, and governments did not possess the police power to regulate which firearms could be possessed and used. So, it is patently incorrect to say that governments enjoyed a robust police power to decide what firearms could be prohibited. The state's attempt to ban these popular firearms creates the extreme policy that a handful of criminals can dictate the conduct and infringe upon the freedom of law-abiding citizens. As Heller explains, the Second Amendment takes certain policy choices and removes them beyond the realm of permissible state action. We're getting back to that fundamental issue there. Does the state have absolute power that they're not supposed to use in a certain way? Or does the state have limited power and there are some things that are just completely and totally outside of their ability? Or as Benita says, removes certain policy choices from the realm of permissible state action. He says, California's answer to the criminal misuse of a few is to disarm its many good residents. That knee-jerk reaction is constitutionally untenable, just as it was 250 years ago. The Second Amendment stands as a shield from government imposition of that policy. There is only one policy enshrined in the Bill of Rights. Guns and ammunition in the hands of criminals, tyrants, and terrorists are dangerous. Guns in the hands of law-abiding, responsible citizens are necessary. To give full life to the core right of self-defense, every law-abiding, responsible individual citizen has a constitutionally protected right to keep and bear firearms, commonly owned and kept for lawful purposes. Unfortunately, governments tend to restrict the right of armed self-defense. Punishing every good citizen because bad ones misuse a gun offends the Constitution. A state Supreme Court in 1878 said it succinctly, "If cowardly and dishonorable men sometimes shoot unarmed men with army pistols or guns, the evil must be prevented by the penitentiary and gallows, and not by a general deprivation of a constitutional privilege." So even though we know we are waiting on that Ninth Circuit Court to give a final ruling to the appeal by the Attorney General of California, this is still a pretty fantastic ruling to read, because I do think that it forced California to bring about some of the best arguments. So it is a catalog of some of the best arguments for disarming the citizenry, and Benitez has collected the best ways to defeat those arguments, the best actual historical evidence, the best actual court precedent. And I do think that he is coming at things from the right foundational position, that there are some things that are just utterly and entirely out of reach of the state. The United States Constitution has limited the civil government to a specific area, and the people who wrote America's laws after that Constitution went into effect would have done so with that presupposition, at least up until, you know, the mid to late 1800s. And that is why the historical test of Bruin is, I think, really, really helpful. Not only does it make chronological sense to say that we're trying to understand the founders' intent, the people who wrote the Bill of Rights and signed that Second Amendment, we need to know what they were thinking by looking at the other laws that they themselves passed. But I think it also is really helpful from an originalist perspective to say that presupposition that existed in the United States after that war for American independence, that government was supposed to be limited, that it was supposed to be in a box, that people had certain unalienable rights given by the laws of nature and nature's God, etc. These were the presuppositions that people worked from in those brand new states. And so to try to read the laws that they wrote the other way, the backwards way, that the state is all powerful and the state mercifully and kindly and arbitrarily grants people the ability to do certain things when it decides that it is safe enough, is going to cause conflict, whether you are a professor or just a random statist on Reddit. That's where you get into some of these word games about usage. The hundreds of millions of firearms in the United States are only being used when they take innocent life, because, you know, that's what guns are designed to do. Kill as many innocent people as possible. Therefore, if they're being used for anything else, it doesn't count as usage. So I hope that you enjoyed going over some of those arguments and appreciate the work that Benitez is doing. And my hope is that this particular case does in fact go all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court does in fact hear it. Now, even if the plaintiffs for this particular case were overruled by the Ninth Circuit and they took it to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court kicked it back down to the Ninth Circuit, that would also be a little bit of a win, because essentially what the Supreme Court be saying at that point is, try again using the precedent that you already have. This doesn't need us to rule on it because we've already ruled on it. We want you to try again. So we will have to wait and see what happens. It's extremely unlikely that this particular Supreme Court would in fact rule against Benitez in this case. And so there's probably a desire to drag this case out as long as possible until there is a Supreme Court that is more favorable. But it can't be done indefinitely, so we probably will get some kind of result at some point in the future. And in the meantime, there's a whole bunch of other gun control things going on. As I mentioned before, several pretty significant losses for the ATF on their frame and receiver definitions and their brace ban. And I'm sure that the ATF will in fact appeal those decisions, but the trend is not particularly good for them. And again, all of those decisions have been made purely on regulatory authority grounds, not even on Second Amendment grounds. So as the ATF makes these different appeals on different grounds, I think their case actually gets weaker. So we'll see how that turns out as well. In the meantime, you should be getting ready for next year, because next year is going to be, in addition to, you know, a regular year in the 21st century, it'll also be an election year. So there will be a lot of other stuff going on. So as always, thank you for listening to this podcast. Let us know over at the T-Rex Arms team at trex-arms.com email address. If you have stuff that you would like us to comment on, that you would like us to cover, corrections or additions, like the folks that pointed out Reno May and his efforts as a plaintiff in a number of these lawsuits. We want to make sure that we are covering the stuff that is necessary and important. And it's always fun to get into some of the wins and talk about some of that foundational stuff. Again, the foundational stuff is where things are really interesting. I'm not saying that the discussions on actual statistical firearm usage are not helpful. It's very important to know these things. But those presuppositions about what defense is, about what rights are, cannot be understated.